This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about the world of books and reading. Today is Friday, April 28th, 2023. We sit here at the precipice of summer. Rebecca, we were just talking summer books for May books for first edition. But if not the wider world of summer, in the publishing world, May ushers in summer reading.
Indeed, it does.
Kind. It's gotten nice here. Got the windows open. It's balmy. I'm wearing shorts. I've got limes ready to be juiced, tequila ready to be shaken. Feeling good today. How are you doing, Rebecca?
I'm good. We're in April showers mode here.
Oh, okay.
It's cool.
You came from
it's
us.
Cool and rainy, but I'm in the middle of a giant novel, and that's exactly what I want. We're at the end of a week of a lot of podcasts and a lot of calls,
oh,
and when I am
Lord.
Done talking to you, I am just going to go back to my nest and read a book. So I'm feeling good.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I'm ready for the promise of summer as well, but I don't hate a moment before the South turns full summer to just, you know, get back in the couch nest for a moment. So I'm ready.
And with this time of year comes moms, dads, and grads recommendations. So we're going to be recording that show a weekish from today. So if you're listening to this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you've got a chance to shoot us an email. We're a little undersubscribed, so you've got a chance to get in there. It is first comes, first serve. We'll see how many we get. Sometimes there's a late rush, but usually it's front-loaded, so I'm not sure what the quietude is about. Of course, now having said that, there'll be 50 that come in tomorrow, but we're going to get to always a fun time on the show. Remember, it's moms, dads, and grads, but it's really just an excuse to do recs. It can be for you. It could be for an aunt. It could be for a teacher. Could be for, you know, your AI-generated personalized chatbot that you want to have a little book club with. I just made that up, but I just terrified myself. I got to be careful out here. Yeah, yeah, I don't like that. So
send your request to podcast@bookriot.com.
Yeah. please don't go to ChatGPT. Maybe that's what everyone's doing. They just pounded their recs into Bing.ai, and they're getting the Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern without even having to consult us.
If ChatGPT can give you a read-alike for the Night Circus that makes you happy, that actually satisfies that request, then I will cede my position to the
algorithm. Just hang them up.
Frankly.
You know, hang them up.
We're done here.
Let's do our first sponsor break, and we'll come back to news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers, and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon, The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
So on first edition, the one that came out most recently, Kelly Jensen and Vanessa Diaz and I, in anticipation of the adaptation of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret by Judy Bloom, which comes out wide today, Friday 28th, we did a little prep. We reread, we did some homework, shared our feelings and our thoughts, had a really good time getting ready for it because we had a suspicion. Hey, it's one of the, it's like, it's a seminal work of the 20th century, or, you know, I made the joke before.
It really is.
It's not seminal. It's whatever the opposite of that is. And it holds up great. And please check out our discussion there if you're interested in the book at all, if you're thinking about the movie. And then the other thing that happened is Kelly got a press screening and she thought it was great. I'll link to her review that she wrote for Book Riot in the show notes. We thought it could be. The vibes were good. We didn't do a confidence index for Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. But if we did, or if we would have, I think we would have given it high marks. I think it checks all of our boxes. From the team that did Edge of 17, which is also a really wonderful, that's YA, not middle grade, which Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is, but a sensibility that feels modern and timeless at the same time. And you put in a note here that it seems to be doing pretty well. I am surprised. Yeah. I didn't think about this. I would have bet, now maybe the default case is that it should be a streamer, but this felt like this would have been a Netflix movie or an Amazon Prime movie. It's going right to theaters. They're doing it the old-fashioned ways, just like it's still 1970.
I love this for so many reasons. I reread Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret this week so that I could be fresh for this adaptation.
I wanted to talk to you about that, but we can do that whenever you want to do that.
Yeah. And then I listened to y'all talk about it on first edition. So I am caught up and ready. I'm so glad it's going wide in theaters and that it looks so good and that it's just like stocked with amazing talent. But it did $600,000 in box office in the Thursday previews yesterday, as we're talking about this. And so that means there's a really strong chance that it could exceed the $7 to $9 million projected opening weekend that they're anticipating for it. The last time that Kelly Freeman Craig and James L. Brooks worked together, as you were saying, was on Edge of 17. And there are noting that Edge of 17 to 220,000 in the Thursday previews, and then it had a 4.75 million opening. So if this tracks there, they'll be looking at like low double digits, maybe a like $10 to $12 million opening weekend for a movie like this. Would just be incredible. There are now like what, maybe three generations of readers, if not four, that have had connections. Yeah, connections and experiences with Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And this like feels like an old-fashioned family movie. Like, it's not a superhero thing. It's not a multiverse. There's not a weird hook. This is just a story about people living their lives. And it's also not supposed to be high art. And, you know, I love movies and I see a lot of them, but there's that, it has felt like over the last couple of years, especially, a really big divide. It's either something that is supposed to be like relatively low to middle brow, fun for the whole family, you won't have to think about anything, or pretty highbrow, big art. And some of those, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, managed to break out and cross over and become like mainstream hits in some way. But this is, there's not a gimmick here. This is just a story about a 12-year-old girl living her 12-year-old girl life with a glimpse into what's going on with her parents as well. I'm super curious to see it and see like how much is about the parents, how much screen time do they get? They don't get much screen time in the book, but are we, you know, evening out the playing field
Yeah, McAdams is a sharp knife not to use to cook a little bit. You know, like the book, the mom is there, but I don't know that you'd think like, well, that's a Rachel McAdams part. Kathy Bates, on the other hand, as the grandmother comes in,
super,
I can imagine,
looking to
like a flamethrower throughout.
Yeah, just really, really wonderful. And I'm so glad for an excuse to have reread the book. Like, I trotted down to my Barnes & Noble and picked up a paperback copy. It's the one where it looks like she's texting God on the cover. Had a lovely afternoon reading it this weekend. It's like, all right. And I just suspect that there are tons of people in our generation and the generations that have come after us that are doing that same thing. Just a chance to revisit a story that meant a lot to us for a variety of reasons as young people. And now the folks in our generations who have had kids are getting to share it with their kids. And that's just really cool and very special.
Yeah. I was thinking about that context of, like, this is a all ages kind of movie. I mean, maybe you're not going to take a 5-year-old to it. I don't know. You could. I mean, it's, unless you're that worried about periods, which you shouldn't be, which is sort of the whole point of the book, but that's still neither here nor there, except that it's still a thing. But this kind of, it's emotional, right? It's about feelings. It's about experiences. It's about relationships. Weirdly, the people that have carved this space out for themselves is Pixar. Like, but it's because, you know, feelings having feelings, or toys having feelings, or dinosaurs having feelings.
It's like Pixar or Noah Baumbach.
Yeah. Well, but that's not for that. Oh, I guess you're like Isle of Dogs or Fantastic Mr. Fox or something like that. But the gimmick here is life. That's what the gimmick is here. It's not, there is no other gimmick to this. And that gimmick still holds up because people are weird. We still don't do very well talking about women's bodies. Puberty is going to be hard for everyone. Even if we talked really a lot all the time about it, there's still no really prepping you for it. Even though, you know, in my kids' generation, it's not perfect. Don't mistake me. It's completely different than what I got at this age.
I bet.
And if you're ever with me at a bar, I will tell you the story of my sex ed class that met at the hospital that I've told in front of you at least a half a dozen times. I had occasion to tell it recently.
Oh. Yeah, I have retold this story to people who've never met you. It's such a good story. That's like the ultimate piece of bonus content that we'll never release, probably.
Yeah, never release. Yeah, that's, you got to pay Folden money for something else like that. But, like, it's so refreshing to see, and it's so overdue, right? I mean, Judy Blume is a living legend, but she hasn't had the big adaptation. You know, that's a threshold. We were talking to someone in a different context this week by why one author isn't bigger than they are. And to jump up into sort of, I'm not talking like LeBron James, you know, that kind of, you know, Rihanna, that kind of, but even where someone could say, oh, who is that? And they're like, oh yeah, I've heard, or maybe you could have even that kind of interaction around someone. I think Judy Blume is as high as you can get without having a signal adaptation that, you know, more people will see this than have probably read the book in like 3 months. I remember the producers of the Rent movie saying something to that effect. It's like, why do this? I mean, I'm sure there's a financial piece of it, but like, more people will see the movie version in the first 6 months that could ever see the Broadway play, just because of the distribution and everything else. So it feels alive. It still feels relevant. I think, you know, it made sense to keep it where it is in terms of the timeline. There's something that makes it even more, I don't know. It takes it, by making it specific in a time that feels long enough ago now, it accentuates the timelessness. But I'm looking forward to see. I don't think we're going to go see it this weekend, but we will see it pretty soon. Your reading experience, was it what you thought? What was your shock of recognition quotient on this thing?
It was, in my memory, this is the book about being a 12-year-old girl where you get your period. And that, like, in my memory, there's so much period stuff. And that is just not true.
It's there.
Right. Yeah. Like, the girls talk about it a couple of times. Margaret buys period supplies and tries them out. I had the same experience that Vanessa and Kelly talked about on First Edition, where when I was a kid, they had not yet updated like the technology in the book to accurate period products for the moment. So they were using sanitary belts in the book. And I was like, what is this?
Suspenders and pulleys and simple machines of various kinds.
Nobody told me that this was going to be involved. Yeah. And Margaret gets her period at the end of the book. But it was so much more about understanding herself in the context of her family, and especially religion, than I remembered. And I'm really curious about how much weight the movie will give that, and how that plays, because it was certainly a question. Like, she talks in the the big struggle for her is that her father was Jewish and her mother was raised Christian, and their families, neither family liked that they were going to marry someone from a different religious tradition. And so they raised Margaret without religion and decided that she would be able to choose her own when she was an adult. But she's like at a new school and the kids all want to know, like, basically, do you go to Sunday school or do you go to Hebrew school? Do you join the Y or do you join the Jewish Community Center? And she can't figure out where she fits in there because she hasn't been given a designated place. How is she supposed to figure this out on her own? And American culture has shifted so far away from your religious community being the center of your cultural identity, like over the last 60 years since this book, 50 years, 60 years since the book first came out, that I don't know how relatable that is to, you know, kids that are going to encounter the book today, to kids that will see the movie. It's just not as central of a question. And I think that's, that contributes to why it's smart to set the movie in the 70s. Yeah. This, you can then say, well, this was how it was back then. But I was surprised by how prominent that is in the themes of the story and how relatively minimal on the page the puberty stuff is, but also how timeless Judy Blume's capturing of sort of the, just the really difficult social dynamics between young girls are, where you want to have friends and be in the group. And sometimes like competitiveness comes in. Do you trust this person or do you not? Do you trust them while they're letting you be in the in-group? But should you really not trust them because tomorrow you'll be in the out-group? Just like that, the difficulty of that math is, I think, just true for every generation, and that she captured it so, so well.
It's like God level writing when you think about the constraints of writing for 10-year-olds, right? This is stuff literary fiction tries to do. How do you relate to other people? How do you be good? How do you be bad? How do you navigate what you want with what other people want? And again, it's not, you know, it's just not going to be, you know, Sally Rooney or something else like that. But it, given the constraints of what it's trying to do and what the audience is, it's a remarkable achievement. And yeah, you know, some people get turned off because of they think there is quite a bit of that, more than I remembered, of the religious stuff. And it's there on the tin. That's like, it's, are you there, God? Right. Like, it's on there, but it's also not that much either. Like, you don't, it's not even about that. It's about being 12. About this particular character being 12. That's what it's about.
Yeah. It's not about, should I believe in God? What would I get from it? Yeah. Which religion is right for me? Like, Margaret thinks that's what she's doing, but she's just trying to understand how she fits in and where, and how to find your place when no one has given you a designated place and a preset context for understanding yourself.
Yeah. So go check out First Edition. We did a long discussion on the most recent episode at the top of that. It was really fun to do. And Vanessa and Kelly were great. I also got inspired because I was doing research for reading. And when you Google, are you there, God, it's me, Margaret, the first thing you realize is there have been 9,000 editions of Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret?
Oh, yes, there have.
And so kind of on a whim, I used the occasion to whip up, you know, I used to be a writer, Rebecca. I used to write sometimes, and I don't get to do
it very often. Yeah, then the internet got us.
Yeah, well, and then, you know, I got different jobs in the old days when I used to do a lot of the writing for the site. Anyway, I used the format of the First Edition Substack to whip together a list in which I assessed the relevance of various editions of Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret's covers to what's actually in the book. And let me just say to you, unto you, it varies.
It sure does.
It varies. It was fun. So you can see that on the Substack and check it out there if you want.
I don't envy the cover designers who have to try to capture this.
I think, like, I do say it's a difficulty of like 10,000 level to get into this, but you can still, like, say, get the Margaret's hair color right. I mean, look, let's at least pick up the easy ones.
There's a lot of angst on those book covers, and there's not a lot of angst on the page. It's maybe my biggest.
Yeah, it's unusual, and it's I think even the marketing to 12-year-olds have gotten older since 1970. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in terms of sophistication necessarily, but I think in terms of how they're marketed to and what they see in the world, which is also very interesting. They don't want to buy books that look like kids' books, where I think when it first came out, or especially in the 80s covers. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to get into it here. I just went into it. But anyway, go check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to see.
It was, I even had a moment like, I know this is a middle grade book, and it felt weird walking into the children's section of Barnes & Noble to get it.
It's a real conundrum because my kids are right now 10 and 12 and they're between, and I'm not saying tween like, you know, a stereotype. And I learned that the tween word was like invented in the late 80s. So there's a reason that didn't feel like it was around in the 70s. It's not mentioned in this book at all, but they can handle a lot more than they used to and not, and they can be really young kids a lot of the time and then not. So it's hard. It's very difficult to see. It's fascinating. That was another, it's a fascinating,
interesting. Another interesting thing coming out of rereading this was, I think in a lot of ways, like 12-year-olds today are more innocent than 12-year-olds were in the 70s. Like children's entertainment is a lot gentler even than children's.
Well, there's a lot more of it. You spend all your time just consuming 10 and 11 year on Disney Plus.
Right.
Whereas even when we were 10 and 12, like you were just exposed to more adult stuff on cable and stuff.
Around. Like Now and Then was a movie that defined my, like, I think probably like 10 to 14 year old viewing. I watched that movie a billion times.
Yeah. Mine was Stand By Me, but I was a little bit older than you are.
But kind of same vibe. And there is a lot of darkness and kind of heavy content to that. Yeah. Like they're dealing with like death of parents. They're dealing with other like really big, difficult issues. One of the girls like fakes dying, jumping off a cliff and drowning and like does it as a joke. But I was like, I rewatched it last summer and I was like, they would never make this movie right now to market it to children. It's just so much darker and more difficult than most of the material. And like that divide between both, kids are more maybe savvy in how they understand media and what's marketed to them, but the content of the media is often like what we consider to be age appropriate has really shifted from when I was that age. And that's just fascinating to see as well. But these issues of like what it's like to be 12.
Pixar kind of figured out how to have big feelings without the darkness. And there's sadness, but it's not darkness in that kind of way. Or like My Girl. They would never make My Girl today.
Right.
It would never
happen. Part of me is like, that's kind of a tragedy because My Girl's wonderful.
Yeah. And horrible. Right. And we also move past the let's kill the dog for pathos version of children's literature. So it comes and goes. But I think what you're hearing us vortex around is how special this text is and how unusual it is even today. And that's what the great ones do. That's what the great ones do.
Long may she reign.
Yeah. Let's do our second sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia Senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden. And thanks again to W.W. Norton and Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
Oh, man. So, look, speaking of things coming back around, a Twilight TV series in the works. Did you see the trailer for the Hunger Games thing?
I did.
That looks so bad. It looks unbelievably terrible. I didn't want this. I didn't want it either. The Harry Potter thing and this thing and this prequel. We are in the Baroque stage of the adaptation Gold Rush. I'm calling it now.
Yeah.
We did hit it. I don't know when. I called it, you know, like I said before, I've called the peak 10 times before it actually happened. But all of this is late stage streaming. That's what this is. That's what this is.
It is. It's late stage streaming. I have a little more generosity for a Twilight reworking because the first, especially Twilight movie, is so bad.
But don't people like it? I thought people liked
it. So, well, I mean, yes.
I don't know. I don't have my sense of it. That is my mental model. You know better than I.
Yeah. I mean, I think the books are not great, but as adaptations go, the movie is like, he's supposed to be sparkling and he just looks kind of sweaty. Like the effects in the first one are not awesome. And there's a way that, you know, CGI has just evolved enough since the first ones came out that adaptations of Twilight could have at least the special effects will be better. Like how well they capture the story or if people are interested in seeing new actors play those iconic roles. Like, can we really have other people be Bella and what's his face? Probably not.
If you have to say what's his face, I think the answer is yes, you could have someone else be what's his face. Just throwing that out there.
But I was not a Twilight stan, so I don't know.
The movies made $3.4 billion worldwide. Yeah. So people went to see these things.
That's
now, whether or not they're firing them up on Netflix on Saturday night with some popcorn,
right.
I don't know.
Is anybody rewatching these? I don't know the answer to that. I also don't know. This is where a book scan account would be useful. How well do these books continue to sell? Like,
great question.
I understand why HBO is like, I understand the business case HBO has made for the Harry Potter thing because those books continue to move. They are passed on from generations of readers. Insert all your standard caveats here that we have discussed ad nauseum about J.K. Rowling and why we don't want to watch that show. Just like, don't add us. We're not endorsing it. I don't know if Twilight is continuing to sell. Like, how does Twilight hold up? Are new generations of teens picking it up and reading it? Or is this like for the Twilight moms? Because Twilight moms do still exist.
Yep.
I was in Forks, Washington last summer, and that is still alive and well. So maybe that's what this is. Maybe that's who the audience is for it. But I just hope the special effects are better. That's all I have to say.
Maybe if you build it, they will come. Like this in this piece that's in Deadline, or excuse me, Hollywood Reporter says, like, this is one of the big IPs that Lion Gates have. And one thing we know is they're going to squeeze IP until they know sure that there's no blood, there's no juice in there. And not only that, they'll squeeze to the point in which they discover there's a razor blade in there. And I guess we'll find out. Just off the top of the dome, if you're taking the Twilight franchise or the Hunger Game franchise into the future right now, which one are you taking? I'm not kidding. I mean, this is not supposed to be a bit, sort of, but like, I don't have a good sense of this because they both seem to me pretty lifeless on the whole, but I was more of a Hunger Games person at large for sure.
Same. And they were both really products of their time.
Yeah.
Man, you know, Twilight was one of the selling points of Twilight was that it was steamy, but quote unquote clean. Like I was bookseller when the books came out.
Because you're so sweaty that you're not going to touch anybody. You're like, I'm so sweaty
there was
that I
like
can't
a
even
certain
hold your hand.
Kind of parent that would endorse this for their kids because it had all the like romance and teenage desire stuff.
I mean, it's
but
the
there's
Amish
not
romance
actual
stuff. We can just say it like there's a yearning. There's a chased yearning vibe in a market for this stuff. That it's fine.
Right. There's
it's just what it is.
And there's not actual sex until like the later books. And I think that the sex happens after they get married. So it fits into a certain kind of moral framework.
It's a promise promise ring
IP. But like Euphoria is what the teens are watching today. So I don't know that they're hungry for the super chaste, just clammy handed romance.
Are they going to punch it up a little bit? You know, put some teeth on those vampires, ironically? I mean, it's possible. I don't know.
I think like just by a hair, I would give the edge to the Hunger Games franchise surviving. There's more interesting, there are more interesting corners to build out in that world. Yeah. I'm not interested in going to any more corners of that world, but I think you could find some new, like the right creator could find some new life for that story, I think a little bit more easily than for Twilight.
Yeah, I was talking to my kid's librarian a couple of weeks ago, and I was just taking her temperature on like what the kids are reading and so on and so forth. And I asked explicitly about the Hunger Games, like, are people picking it up? Because I was thinking for my older son, 10's a little young. I mean, Hunger Games is pretty grisly. And it's not that Rowan couldn't handle it. My daughter, she just doesn't enjoy that. Like, she doesn't like violence. She's doesn't find it interesting, like turns away, like physically, is like, I'm out. I'm just going to get out of here. But with Ames, and she's like, not really. I mean, some, and it comes and goes. I think the Shadow and Bone series has done a lot of work. Apparently they're reading Shadow and Bone a lot. They're picking those things up. And then all the books, frankly, that the Hunger Games and Twilight and Harry Potter rot, Keeper of Lost Cities, there's a whole bunch of these giant, chunky, middle grade fantasies that have come out to fill the same hunger, to the point that my daughter's teacher said in our parent teacher conference that he's encouraging Rowan and encouraging us to encourage her to read something that's not big, chunky fantasy. Like, that's great to read something,
interesting,
but they get so into it that they don't try other stuff because there's just so much of this. So I guess this is all feeding into the same kind of a question, because in hindsight, it's hard to remember even in the moment how huge these franchises were. These middle grade to YA to Hunger Games by the end is kind of adult. Like, Mockingjay's pretty rough. Like, it's about PTSD and people are getting aced in the face left and right. Like, it's not great. But it's so wild to have this stuff, because these things are even newer than Harry, right? I mean, the first Harry Potter book comes out in 96. These things are a decade later. So it's all so much newer. Not what I want myself, but if people like it, and you know, it's doesn't, everything doesn't have to be for me, but kind of bummed to see it. I was really because I had thought about reading Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. I really liked, I liked that whole series. I even actually liked Mockingjay better. I know you didn't, and a lot of people didn't like the end of that very well, but I'm the outlier there. But, and I was like, if the movie looks cool, I'll go read it and I'll do a segment on what was the Hunger Games and maybe still do that. But I watched the trailer. I was like, it looks so bad. I can't believe it.
I think at this point, I mean, it's 15 years out since Mockingjay almost. Maybe more than that. And it's just hard to keep any story feeling fresh that long. It's very much like late stage streaming, and also the like thing we've been talking about with movie studios having preference for existing IP, because audiences do seem in some ways to want that, the thing that's familiar and predictable. But like, as readers who like messy literary fiction and some stuff that does something new, show me something I haven't seen before. That's what I want. Something surprising and weird and interesting that I haven't seen before. I don't really want a predictable experience, or that's not what I always want. I'd like the option for something interesting and weird. That's like, there's so much money here, and to just see it going into like giving second life to things whose first lives weren't really that long ago, when we could be investing in new creators, new art, new stories, new ways of seeing the world. Yeah, that's the real bummer to me here.
And since there is so much streaming, I understand why, because if you make a Twilight or a Hunger Games thing, you don't have to do you don't have to do the first thing, which is tell the people what the hell it is, which is kind of the hardest thing. Like, when we're talking about debut literary fiction, the hardest thing is telling people what it is and why they should care. And you've already cleared that bar. Now, you know, there's limitations to that and so on and so forth, but I get it. I definitely get it. It's so strange to be in a world in which things that you saw and read as an adult are being remade already.
Right. And like, we're not that old. Yeah. I'm ready to see big remakes like 30 years out, seems right. A full generation. But like, no, it's too soon.
Speaking of things we don't like, I don't think we're going to like break this down in utter detail, but I think it's telling and important to keep our eyes on not just the, I guess, the actions of banning, censoring, and otherwise strip mining the libraries and curricula of, let's be honest, LGBTQ+ content. It's just, that's what it is. This is the top 13 most challenged books of 22 as compiled by the American Library Association. Number one, and the number of challenges I think is telling too. It's Genderqueer by Maya Kobabe. We've talked about this on the show before. It was challenged 151 times. LGBTQ plus content, claimed to be sexually explicit. The next one's All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson, 86 times. So Genderqueer, almost twice the number of challenges. This has become the poster text for this.
If the book were called anything other than Genderqueer, you know, something less incendiary to a particular population, it would be really interesting to know what that is. Like the title does a lot of the work there. And I think it's smart because it will attract a reader who is looking for a story and needs that story, that representation, needs whatever this book has to offer. But it also has that Streisand effect of it will attract.
And also for people who don't even read things before they ban them, this one's easy.
Exactly. You can just look at the cover and be like, well, it says Genderqueer. It must be bad. In the same way that one of the ones farther down the list, This Book Is Gay by Juno Dawson.
Just lean into it, right? They're going to come for you anyway. Yeah. Just wave it, baby.
Right. You don't have to read that book. And we know that they're not reading that book before they challenge it. The fact that it's a big rainbow cover and says this book is gay is kind of all tells them everything that they need to know.
And you know, the Queen Tony holding it down at number three, 73 challenges for The Bluest Eye. I'm not going to defend anything on here. I'm going to make this absolutely clear right now, just before I say the next thing. It's the only really fully adult title on here. This is not a YA title. I kind of get it. Like, this is an adult title. Now, reading something at 13 is different reading at 17. Like, my first Morrison I read in high school at 17, 18. It's tough for anyone of any age, but this one I kind of get because it's not a kid's book. And it's like 12-year-olds. Probably I wouldn't recommend it. I'm certainly not going to take it out of the library. Don't make any mistake. Again, you hear all the caveats on my voice. But this is an adult book that's hard for adults to read. This is the only one like I can see a case where like maybe don't push it forward at the very least. But that's enough. That's all I'm going to say about that because it's tough.
Yeah. The piece that perked my ears up, eyes up about the challenges on The Bluest Eye, and I haven't gotten into the deep content about it, is that one of the objections to it is that it has EDI content, which is the same. It's diversity, equity, and inclusion content.
Well, those people ALA can go jump off something high, but that's a different.
Right, but also like how you can read The Bluest Eye is about a lot of things and certainly gets at race and class and identity, but you have to be doing some kind of like really twisted half critical reading to arrive at this is diversity.
You're stupid
content
and mean and twisted. Yeah. I mean, that's just what that is. Some old familiar faces here. Absolutely True Story of a Part-Time Indian. This has been around since we've been doing the show. The other one, you know, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, that comes and goes. I think the ones that don't have LGBTQ plus explicitly on it have been around for a while. I guess A Court of Mist and Fury by Sarah J. Maas, remember, this was the title at the subject of the effort in Virginia just to get these out of Barnes and Nobles. That was really testing. That was really a heat check from the banners. Like, can we come after the stores for even carrying it or putting it in a specific section? There's some pretty spicy sex stuff in there. Again, I'm not saying to get out of the library, but anything that's not about LGBTQ plus here is about an outlier on these lists. That's just what it is. I don't know what to say.
Just
I don't know what to say that adds anything to the discourse here. Talking about it. I don't know.
We're seeing people just object to textual acknowledgement that young people have sexual desires, urges, identities, and behaviors. Like I'm a little surprised every year that the Sherman Alexie one stays on the list because it is so relatively tame, you know, against like how spicy some of the Sarah J. Maas is. Like, the character just refers to masturbation. There's not even a description of it. He just refers to that. He's like a champion of it because he's a teenage boy and most of them are.
I wonder if there's a certain like momentum to have it been challenged for a while. Like, it's just known. It's like how people know Finnegan Wake is hard, even though they haven't even cracked it open. It's like, these lists and these challenges. They're just ready.
You're primed to challenge books and you see this on your kids' reading list and you have seen that it's been challenged elsewhere. You just take it, you know? This broad claim that a book is sexually explicit can mean all kinds of things. And it seems to mean, you know, all kinds of things to the book banners. But yeah, it's about, we know this is not really about books. No. It's about control. And the note here that Kelly Jensen made when she covered this for Book Riot was usually this is a top 10 list, but this year it is a top 13 because there's a four-way tie for 10th place. And as we noted a couple of weeks ago, the number of challenges in 2022 was nearly doubled the number from 2021. So the troubling trend remains troubling.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm now in tab navigation. Oh, Barnes & Noble. I need to talk to the PR rep for Barnes & Noble because James Daunt is available.
He is. He's everywhere.
He's everywhere. You put this in here. I don't know. They're doing well. Their returns. So if you are interested in accounting and also the book business, one thing you may be interested in, I just lost everyone. Like, you know, everyone's gone. But one of the things for a bookstore to operate efficiently is to get the number of returns down. That means books they keep on their shelves, they don't ultimately sell, and then return for the publisher. Bookstores are weird in this regard, in which they can just return the books and get their money back. And the reason I believe that this happens is publishers do not want to disincentivize bookstores from carrying stuff. They don't want to have to make it like we're burning money and taking a chance on this book, because they will become more conservative. There'll be fewer title stock and fewer copies of them. And that's not what booksellers want. They want there to be a bunch. They want to be able to put that literary debut title on a shelf and at least give it a chance. Whereas Barnes & Noble's already started to do a little bit of this. We talked about this middle grade of like, if it doesn't have a sales record, we're not going to take up the shelf space to put it on there. So anything that happens, and I think this is part of it, they're saying, we know what kind of books aren't going to sell to a certain degree. We're not going to carry as many of them, so we're not doing as many returns. I guess this is them working. Is this how I win to quote Uncut Gems? Is this how Barnes & Noble wins at this?
I think it's also, Dot notes farther down in this interview, that a lot of this has to do with ending the co-op agreements that allowed publishers to pay for placement in the store. And so, you know, that gave publishers a guarantee that your book will be in the store and it will be in a place where you paid for it to appear, where customers are more likely to encounter it. One of the things James Daunt didn't like about that is that it makes all the stores the same. And he's very much about individual stores having the autonomy to know their communities and select the titles for their stores that they think are the best fits. And so he's attributing this decrease mostly to the co-op agreements having gone away. That when they had the co-op agreements, the chain Barnes & Noble was returning about 30% of its inventory unsold, which was $1 billion worth of books every year. And that's down to 7%. But he notes that when you're running a bookstore properly, it's about 3%. So, but that decrease from a 30%, but from 30% down to 7 is really notable. And it does point to the idea that, like, they are returning fewer books. And it seems because the stores are able to select the titles based on what they think people coming into the store are actually going to buy. They're not taking up table space and shelf space with the things the publishers want to put in front of readers. Yeah. And this is like the central conundrum of book discoverability, the gap between what a publisher wants you to discover and what you actually want to read. And it seems like Barnes & Noble, is under Daunt's leadership, is dialing closer to helping readers discover what readers are interested in. And filling up less of their shelf space with just what publishers want to, you know, push, for lack of a better word.
The flips, and, you know, this also goes with, along with their strategy sort of hand in glove, which is also having smaller stores so you don't carry as many titles, which means you don't have as much inventory management, you don't need as many employees, you have to pay for the square footage, all the things that go into that. But there is a certain inexorable logic of that, which is, just carry the 20 best-selling books. Like, that's the reducto ad absurdum of that. And I'm not sure that wouldn't work, right? I've thought about this. Like, what if you're a coffee shop and all you stock, and you also stocked a few books, and you just picked the home runs? Like, your return rate would be close to zero. But we also kind of don't want
that. It's basically like,
right?
What Hudson News is doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or like an airport or Target or something like that. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But like, we also don't want that because we want to have sort of abundance of choice for especially a book person. You don't want to walk into a bookstore to have a bookstore experience like you know everything that's there. On the other hand, and how fair is that? But also, what other store do you expect it of to be a Barnes & Noble? I mean, I guess Best Buy is the equivalent. Like, it's not like you walk into Target, we have all the clothes, like every single clothes that you could buy. That's not the expectation of some other stores.
You know, I go to my local Barnes & Noble like once a month, do a walk around, see what's happening. Yeah. Usually at 3 p.m. to see what the kids are going to put on TikTok. Yeah,
drinking your Frappuccinos and making the talks.
And I know a lot about the books that are coming out because we pay attention to things, but I'm seeing, at least in my local stores, like the front tables and the themed tables that the booksellers have put together often have titles either that I haven't read or even that I wasn't aware of. I assume that my reading and awareness is significantly higher than the average person wandering through a Barnes & Noble.
Yes, I would think so. I would hope
so. Any given day. Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption. And so if I can still discover something that I haven't read yet on a table that's being curated by my local booksellers, I think that's a pretty strong piece of anecdata. I'll acknowledge that it's anecdata, but I think it's pretty strong that this idea of letting the stores do the buying seems to be, it's either working or if nothing else, it's not working. Their inventory returns are down, sales are up. Barnes & Noble seems to have been pointed back in the right direction that you want to see a business going. This change also allowed them to cut a lot of staff at the corporate level, because if you don't have to tell the people in the stores what to put on the tables,
to the
you
field
don't need
officers.
People.
Yeah, that's happened.
Yeah, you don't need people in those offices doing the telling. It's all happening out in the field. And I feel pretty good about it. You know, like I was a little confused about why I had to wander all the way back to the children's section to find Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, a week before this movie was coming out. It
That's
wasn't on any of the big front
question.
Tables.
There's not a movie tie-in edition as far as I can tell. I'm shocked.
Yeah, there's
I'm genuinely
not.
Shocked.
It's really surprising. Maybe the publisher was just didn't anticipate there to be much additional demand for that book. It's probably got pretty steady backlist sales as it goes. Who knows? But there's, you know, a full table full of like rom-coms to read this summer. All the covers look the same, but I hadn't heard of half of them. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, Barnes & Noble, like, you are the buyers, at least in my local store, seem to be doing the thing that they're supposed to be doing, which is pulling in stuff that will help the reader wandering in that door to discover something that they want to take home with them. And it's just not the same stuff that the publisher is hoping that they'll sell, or not necessarily the same stuff.
I would, I'm not sure how much more Barnes & Noble talk there is going to be in general if they kind of keep humming along. But all these stories talk about, we let the local sellers decide what to stock. Is there really that much variance? I mean, yeah. I would like to see a diff table on like what the Barnes & Noble in this suburb versus this suburb look like in different parts of the country. I would guess at the margin, you know, like Matthew McConaughey sells great in Texas. I'm sure there's stuff like that. Is that enough? Is that all we're really talking about? Maybe that's the kind of thing, like Book People in Austin, that's their like third best-selling book still every week. And
amazing.
If the Barnes & Noble isn't having a stack of those available at all times, maybe that's dumb. I was like, you look at the sales and I just don't see what's so hyper-local. It feels like it's only a marginal difference, I guess what I'm saying. I find it hard to believe it makes that much difference.
I think that's a great question. The hyperlocality of it might not be the thing. It might just be Daunt having been like, you know what, publishers don't get to decide what books we're putting on our shelves anymore.
And maybe fewer titles plus the end of co-op, that itself in combination with a little margin, like maybe you get 3-4% and something like a 12% increase. Like that can really matter. Mm-hmm. But like the actual experience, like if you blindfolded me and took me to a Barnes & Noble and unblindfolded me, walk it in and did that for like 6 Barnes & Nobles around the country, would I be like, oh my God, look at, I just don't believe it. It doesn't pass my
experiential test
of these things.
How different is my Richmond Barnes & Noble from your Portland Barnes & Noble? Probably not terribly.
You know what? We're finally going to go video. We're going to do side-by-side TikToks of us walking around our local Barnes & Noble, looking what's different. We cracked our video strategy, Rebecca. You did it.
I knew the day would come. Just waiting for inspiration to strike.
I think that better be our show. On that note, Rebecca, thank you so much. As always, you can email us your mom's, dad's, and grad's recommendation requests at podcast@bookriot.com. Check out First Edition everywhere you hear podcasts. Rebecca and I will be talking on that show about the It Books of May. We'll be doing our knockout rounds there. A lot of fun. Again, that comes out on the 3rd, on Wednesday the 3rd. But our April knockout round on the First Edition, the First episode, I'm doing this all the time. go check that out. Also, my Substack that I'm doing a little ancillary content for. Put a link to my Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. Very, very impromptu discussion of some of the titles. I guess that's everything for this week, Rebecca. We'll talk to you real soon.
All right. Have a good one.